Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Jan Fran is back. I am a huge Jan Fran fan. I just think she's got a brilliant mind. She's super funny. I really enjoyed catching up with her. Again, if you've not heard the old episode, it is referenced a couple of times in this episode. So go back and find that one. And also, this was recorded on, I'm going to timestamp it, Monday, June the 1st, just because obviously we talk about a bunch of things that are going on in America and in the world right now, and those things are changing so drastically from day to day. So this was what we thought at 2 o'clock on Monday afternoon, June 1st. And I hope that I hope things are a lot calmer than they were, but I fear that they won't be. So anyway, let's not linger on things that we can't possibly know anything about. But I think you're really going to enjoy this episode with Fran. Check out The Briefing, which is her podcast, the daily news podcast, and it's absolutely fantastic. So I would recommend The Briefing. And I have a Patreon page. We talk a little bit about Patreon at the end and the connection that it's given me with the audience during this time and how that's been quite important for me. So there's a bit of a chat about that at the end of the episode as well, if you stick around for that. But you can join up at Patreon, patreon.com, patreon.com/Willosophy, WILOSOPHY. And support the podcast. It's a way to basically crowdfund. If we could double the amount of subscribers that we have on there at the moment, I think we could probably get to the point where I could put out a couple of episodes a week. I've been enjoying these catch-up episodes, and I was thinking that once I'm able to do face-to-face interviews again, it might be nice to combine, one brand new episode face-to-face and one, on Skype catch up with a previous guest to update their life. So if we could get up to double the amount of subscribers we have now to the Willosophy Patreon page, I'd probably be able to afford to get James to do the art for 2 episodes a week and Mike to edit 2 episodes a week, because obviously if I do more episodes, the costs go up. So basically that's why I could afford to do it then. So anyway, it's been great. And thank you to everyone who's already supporting, because I know these can be incredibly tough times for people. And I really genuinely appreciate it. And thank you very much. I hope you enjoy this episode with Jan Fran. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. And what we're doing during this pandemic lockdown is, instead of interviewing new guests, because I like to do those interviews face-to-face, what I am doing is catching up with previous guests on the podcast to see maybe if their life has changed, and if so, how it has changed during these unprecedented times. I believe I'm the person who coined that expression. And remember, at Willosophy, we're here for you. So the podcast always starts the same way. I ask the guests who they are. Who are you, returning guest?
G'day, I'm Jan Fran. I am a journalist and person on the internet. And you're right, Will, I've never heard the phrase unprecedented being used anytime, let alone in the last few months. So well done on coining it yourself, sir.
It is amazing, I think, just to start on a very trivial matter before we jump in the deep end, the way that language so quickly evolves. So there are certain phrases, unprecedented, or those advertising, you know, phrases that are being used endlessly in these unusual times, in these difficult times, you know, we're here for you, this major corporation. There's all that happening. But just the idea of Zoom meetings, or the idea of social distancing, all this language that is immediately thrust upon us, we really kind of stop down and actually think about the fact that everybody in the world now has 10 different words that they use.
Yeah, totally. I found myself using "hope you're well" in these dark and uncertain times. That has been my go-to email phrase, and I apologize if anyone's ever received an email from me that had that sentence in it, but that's the one that I've been using, because you know, part of it is that you don't know what to say. It's such a weird, I mean, I don't want to have to say it, but it's an unprecedented time, Will.
And it's without precedence, at least in our lifetimes.
Yeah, totally. And so you're not really quite sure what to say, especially if you're reaching out to someone via email. Or it's like, do you acknowledge it? Do you not acknowledge it? So I've just found dark. I've settled on dark and uncertain times, which might be a bit much, frankly. But it sort of evokes like very kind of plague-ish, you know, a days of yore. But
it feels like the opening line to some sort of grim historical novel. Does. You know, it's your equivalent of "It was a dark and stormy night." I feel
that's what it is. Yeah, and you know what? I've gone with it. I'm sticking with it. I'm not apologizing, and I'll probably do it again.
It's well, because it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, we are starting with something very small, but the idea that the thing is so big that it is hard not to acknowledge it. It feels like you do have to say something, and we've all been working on our little version of what that something is, but it feels so huge that you just can't have an interaction in any other way without acknowledging, you know, the big bad in the room.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, there's got to be some leeway for language around here as well. It's like if someone says something weird, you just got to let it go, okay? You got to let it go. Do not hold it against them forever. It's a dark and uncertain time, and we're all in this together.
As a journalist, I was reading a really interesting thing yesterday, and this will get us into, obviously, don't know if you've heard, but America is imploding in front of our eyes. Yes. When empires fall, they fall very quickly and very violently, it turns out. But there was a great article I was reading yesterday around the language that is used in news reports and the difference between active voice and passive voice when it comes to interactions between authority and between the citizens, and how often, you know, the use of the passive voice is used to diminish, you know, the violence of the acts or the meaning of the moment. As a journalist, how do you think about that idea of how am I presenting this, even in the tone and language I am using when I'm talking about something?
Oh man, that's something that I think about all the time. I give you an example of something that sort of happened very recently. It was a story about a car that drove rather accidentally into a hijab shop in Western Sydney. So a hijab shop is, you know, it's a store for, I guess, Muslims and particularly Muslim women that sells head coverings. And the car ran off the road. It drove into this store. Luckily, no one was injured. And I think I saw a headline the day afterwards that said, you know, police say that it wasn't a terrorist attack. And I thought to myself, why are we even mentioning the word terrorist attack when someone has run off the road and driven this car into this store? Like if somebody had driven a ute into a fish and chip shop, would we associate that with any kind of terror? No, of course not. But the association was that it happened in Western Sydney and that it was a hijab store that sold clothing for Muslim women, and therefore we make these very strange assertions in our mind and then print them in the paper. You know, so I think sometimes when that happens, I think like, why is it that we associate certain things with certain people? And it's been rote for so long that it almost feels like just second nature to do. Or something, we don't really think about it too hard.
And to unpack it even further, because what this needs is a, you know, middle-aged white guy to unpack it, to really find depth and meaning in it. But to unpack it even further, the idea that when we hear terrorism, like, because if, say, for example, most likely scenario, if there is a terrorist incident where a car drives into a hijab shop, it's probably going to be white terrorism against Muslim people, right? That, because it's a place where there would be Muslim women gathered. But when you hear terrorism used in news reports, the immediate place that it takes you to is not white on brown terrorism. It's the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have associations in our mind of terrorists being Muslim, terrorists being Middle Eastern, terrorists being foreigners. And I think we have come to see and understand you know, very starkly, I suppose, that terrorism takes all forms, all colours, all sorts of people. And we've seen that in the worst possible way with the Christchurch massacre, you know. But we definitely do have associations of terrorism that we ascribe to, particularly, I think, men, and particularly Muslim men or Middle Eastern men.
Okay, so I need to talk to you about what's happening in America, because, you know, speaking about the pandemic being the big thing that you can't ignore at the moment, obviously, you know, sparked by an incredible act of police violence and racial injustice, you know, there are riots now all over the United States of America between, you know, peaceful protesters, you know, looters of any description, I think probably, you know, there's plenty of great voices that you can read about, you know, the capacity to loot or not loot and what the, you know, economic circumstances of somebody or the frustration with the system. And, you know, that's not the time in this question to get to all of that, like, you know, talk to any of it that you want to talk to it. But what do you see when you look at America right now, and do you have fear of how it stops?
Oh man, it's you know, I've probably, like everyone else, has watched America just slide further and further into deep uncertainty, further and further into you know, very sort of overt manifestations of racism that you would not have seen of several years ago. And I say overt because, I mean, racism, both in America and here, and I'm sure that we'll get to that in a second. You know, it is overt.
I can't imagine. I've never experienced any racism in Australia. And if I haven't experienced it, then...
It doesn't exist!
I believe that's how it works.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Australia is absolutely perfect. But, you know, I've sort of just seen this country just become even more of a tinderbox, really, than what it had been. I remember I shot a documentary in the lead up to the US election in 2016, and then I was there again in 2017. And this was 2016 was before Trump won, so we sort of had no idea what was going to happen. 2017 was a year into Trump winning, so I went sort of around about October both years. And I used the same crew, so it's the same camera guy, and his name was Adam Rosenberg. And I remember thinking in 2017, and this is the first time I had ever thought it, I thought to myself, I wonder if we should get Adam to change his name or something. Because we were going into the South, and we were going into, you know, places where you'd heard were quite racist or maybe quite, you know, ignorant or perhaps xenophobic. That thought had never occurred to me to do. And it was just really interesting that I had that thought a year after Trump won and a year after I'd already gone and shot a documentary. The tone had changed so much and the mood had changed so much that fear was just something that that now felt embedded in your life and your work. And I say this as an outsider, as someone who, you know, flew in and flew out and shot a documentary. Imagine what Americans are feeling in this moment. If I felt that so acutely from one year to the next, imagine what it is like to be American and to hear that, you know, Muslims have been banned from entering the country. To hear that that there are good people on both sides when you have people protesting, saying Jews will not replace us. Imagine seeing people with tiki torches in the streets saying Jews will not replace us and the president coming out and calling them very, very good people. You have very good people on both sides. Like, when in your wildest dreams did you think that you would see actual Nazis on the streets of America? And let us not pretend that they are anything else. If you are carrying a tiki torch and you are chanting the phrase Jews will not replace us, you're a fucking Nazi. You know? And that's what I've seen. That's what we've all seen America descend into, I think. And I think, you know, there's been more eyes on the United States since Trump, I guess, you know, took over the presidency. And it just feels like, you know, you have this man who is, he's a misogynist. He is, you know, he has got a very sort of questionable history around race. His tweets are, I don't even know what to make of them anymore, because every day it just seems like the president has said something more ridiculous than what he said yesterday. And I'm not sure how to interpret that anymore. And kudos to the journalists who are in there asking questions of Donald Trump day in and day out. So in many ways, I'm sort of not surprised really that the States is where it is at the moment. But fuck, it's sad. I don't know really what else to say. Like, it's, yeah.
I mean, I lived there on and off for 10 years and I have a great deal of affection for it and, you know, traveled all over it. You know, probably saw more of it than a lot of Americans have because, you know, I played comedy clubs in over 20 states, you know, in the US over the 10 years that I was there. And the other night I was watching footage of, you know, police riots with citizens down the corner of the street that I used to live on. And just, I said to a friend, when the pandemic first started and everything got shut down and people were stockpiling, you know, weapons in America rather than the toilet paper that we were stockpiling here, I said to a friend that I was extremely worried because I said, I think there's going to be looting and I think there's going to be riots. And then it actually came as a great surprise to me that during the time of just the pandemic lockdown, that those things didn't really happen. But then to have this completely separate in some ways, but with so many of the same themes that the people who are at home and being angry are already feeling, you had this amazing tinderbox, I think, probably building up in anger and aggression. And then this inciting incident has brought so many different groups into play. And also just the thing that we aren't talking about at the moment, because there is so much frontline violence that we have to deal with what's happening, is that secondary thing of they're still in the middle of a pandemic. These are large groups of people, many of them not social distancing or wearing masks or any of these things. We don't know what the effects a fortnight from now will be of, you know, the reports that a few people had COVID at these rallies. And it just, to me, for all his faults, and there are many, and, you know, we could get into that if we needed to, that Obama had, in a moment like this, you could rely on him to at least be making a speech to the nation, trying to bring people together and stop things from being on fire. But instead we, you know, look to Killer Mike. I mean, the idea that 2020, like Run the Jewels are my favorite, band in the world at the moment. Like, their new album comes out in 4 days. I've been counting it down for about 2 months. It's 2 days after my girlfriend's birthday. She knows I'm more excited about the album than her birthday. I'm trying to keep equal levels of excitement to both, but she knows that I love those guys. But you see Killer Mike on TV, a fucking rapper having to do what the president is meant to be doing in that situation. How does it stop? How does this resolve itself and calm down rather than continue to escalate and America just burns to the ground?
I mean, I have no idea how it's going to resolve when the president tweets something like when the looting starts, the shooting starts. I mean, this is the caliber of the leader that you're dealing with. Is that what we need in this time? People have taken to the streets because they are so fed up. I mean, we've seen in the last just few days, you know, Ahmaud Arbery was shot going for a jog. He was chased and shot because he was jogging while black. And then, you know, stories start coming out about some 2017 conviction or charge or 2017 scuffle with the police. It's like, are you fucking serious? You can't just have a situation where this man is not a criminal. Like, you cannot see this person as an innocent human being who was shot while jogging. You need to criminalize this black man. So you're pulling out some bullshit from 2017. He was shot while jogging. There was what's that gentleman's name in Central Park? Let me make sure I get his name right. Christian Cooper in Central Park, who recorded that video of the woman who said to him, "I'm going to call the police and I'm going to tell them that there's a black man threatening me." Because she knows exactly what'll happen if the police show up and there's a black man and a white woman. they're going to side with the white woman. And she knew that, and she weaponized that against him. And then you have George Floyd's situation, where a policeman has his knee on his neck for 8 minutes, and the man is telling him, "I cannot breathe." And there are bystanders saying, "This man cannot breathe. Get off him." And he dies. Like, how long are you meant to remain silent about that, right? And this is to say that people have not remained silent about it. I mean, Colin Kaepernick has been kneeling in the United States protesting this shit for years, and he has copped shit for it, you know? So now you have protesters copping shit for protesting and for being violent and for being rowdy and for looting. But you also have Colin Kaepernick copping shit for protesting while being gentle and just kneeling on a football field. Like, how are you meant to protest, man?
And not just kneeling on a football field. Like, the thing that we always have to remember about Colin Kaepernick is that willing to sacrifice his livelihood and his career for his principles, because he didn't just kneel on the field and get like a fine. He was able to play sport at the highest level, and that was taken away from him because he refused to, you know, not make that protest. He was willing to actually lose something substantial to him. People of these marginalized communities have been saying this, of course, forever. This is the thing I always feel as a person who, you know, has my eyes opened constantly to other people's, you know, life experiences, because, you know, if you're a, you know, straight white man growing up in Australia, you know, everything is made for you, so you don't notice often, you know, like, and I think that it's your responsibility to learn and to understand and to have your eyes opened. And I also think that when you learn about it and you want to speak about it, you've got to acknowledge that the people who have been going through it have been speaking about it the whole time and nobody's been listening.
The whole time, and nobody has been listening. And this is the point I'll make about, you know, police brutality and incarceration here in Australia. I saw a news report where the reporter was talking to some men who are protesting in the United States, and she says, "Yeah, well, I just, you know, thanks for talking to me. I don't think Australians really understand police brutality in the same way that Americans do." And I thought to myself, really? You don't understand it. But there are Australians in this country who have lived with police brutality for 200 years. And believe me, they understand it, you know. And I think if you are concerned about police brutality over in the US, and, you know, you're showing solidarity and you're outraged and you're livid, as you probably should be, I think you should really look at what's going on here in Australia with police brutality and Indigenous incarceration rates, because it is a national fucking shame, man. Like, we had a Royal Commission in 1991. Because we knew this shit was happening. So we had a Royal Commission about it, right? In the hopes that once we ascertain exactly what's going on, this never happens again. Do you know that more than one Indigenous person has died at the hands of police or in incarceration every single month for the last 30 years? And this is specifically the last 30 years since a Royal Commission was established to ensure that this doesn't happen again. More than one Indigenous person dies every month in incarceration or at the hands of police. That has been happening for 30 years. I mean, what the fuck?
So Briggs did this podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned something that I've mentioned a couple of times since in other conversations, but I just think it's one of those things that I might just keep mentioning every time I have an opportunity to mention it, because I think it's just such a important and powerful point that he made, which was that when they announced the initial pandemic restrictions, the guidelines went on the news and it was like, you know, you can do this, you can do that. If you're over the age of 70, or if you have any respiratory, you know, don't go out of the house, you're in a danger zone. And if you're Indigenous, if you're over the age of 50. And he said, it just goes up there on the news and we don't stop down and go, hang on, why is there a 20-year discrepancy between those two bits of information that you've just had to put out there? And that, combined with what you've just spoken about, how do we, and I've seen it already online, how do we take what is happening in the US and have a proper conversation about what is happening in Australia?
The first thing you need to do is listen, read, and follow Indigenous writers, authors, public figures, artists. If you really care and you really want to know about what's going on, there are people who have been leading this conversation for decades, if not centuries. So stop and listen to what they have to say, read what they are writing, listen to the art that they produce, and engage with them and with their work. Do not have an opinion. I mean, you can, but just allow the space.
You don't need to yet.
Between stimulus and you don't need to yet, you know, allow for there to be a space between stimulus and response. Allow for there to be a space between what you are reading and what you are engaging with and how you respond to it. Create that space. And that space is taken away from us with social media. Social media does not encourage this space at all. But this is the most important space in, I would argue, in one's life, that space between stimulus and response, between what you see and what you hear and what comes in and how you respond to it. Create that space. So point number one, if you are interested and you genuinely care, you listen to Indigenous people. Point number two, you show up. Join a protest. Look at an organization that works in this kind of space and volunteer with them. You know, spruik them on social media. Let people know about them. Or donate. You know, if you're thinking of a charity or you're thinking of a place to put your money, well, think about a place that operates in this space. You know, you don't have to do all three at the same time. It's fine. You don't have to read every single book that's ever written. Just start. Start somewhere. And that's how we progress the conversation, is by letting the people who know about it speak and supporting them.
Thank you for that. That's actually so much better an answer than I could have hoped for to that question, because I realized as I was asking the question, I was like, what do we do? Which is a hard question to ask anyone. And you had a really great answer for it, which I absolutely appreciate. But there was one bit of it I just want to, in a more philosophy sort of way, just go back on and have a little chat about, which is that idea about not needing to have an opinion immediately. Like the idea of going, I want to have an opinion on this, but first maybe I should go and, you know, find out what a whole bunch of other people think and read some and you know, then come up with my opinion. You don't need to lock in on your opinion at the start and have it change. You can actually say, I don't have an opinion on this, but I'm going to go away and learn something about it and come back with an opinion.
Yeah, please do. It's a long game you're playing here, right? And I think it's okay to not have an answer to things. I think, as you know, as well, we kind of have to look at the ways that these mediums, sometimes I think they encourage the worst of us. I know for myself, I'm so much better IRL than I am on social media, you know, because on social media I feel, and this is, you know, when I refer to social media, it's like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, to some extent YouTube. I'm much more of a passive participant in YouTube than an active one, but I sometimes clock myself, and I'm usually quite reactive, and I'm quite impatient, and I act with a lot of ego. I feel like sometimes I need to be right, or I need to present that I am right. So there's a lot of ego there. I feel defensive. You know, all of these traits that I'm not my best self. They're not the best me. You know, they're traits that everyone has, and I feel like being on social media exacerbates those parts of me, and I'm much better when I take myself out of that space and I sit with the ideas and I think on them and I read a little bit further about them, and whether or not I come to an opinion, it doesn't matter. What matters is that I try as much as possible. I don't succeed all the time. But the importance of just being able to create a space for yourself between stimulus and response, between what you see and what you hear and what somebody says and how you're going to respond to it. And speaking of sort of the philosophy, I think our first step that we did together, I sort of said that like one of my mantras was, how are you going to act? Which I think speaks to that point quite a lot, because you will hear shit and you will see shit and people will say shit on social media. And it's like, okay, how are you going to act about that? And when you ask yourself that question, what you're actually doing is creating that space between that stimulus and your response to it. And I think that's really important.
Can I share something with you that I've been thinking about quite a lot recently? I think that if I could look at my life, I think the times when I've become happiest about who I am have also followed times when I've been least happy about who I am. So what is really important to me, those values that are important to me, often if you're just living your life normally, you're not thinking about actively, but if you're in some situation where those values are being tested, you're suddenly like, no, this is really important to me and I need to be out of this situation. So it makes you actively think about, you know, how you're going to act, what sort of person am I going to be? And I've reflected recently on social media, because I love social media again now. And I think the reason is that it taught me what my worst qualities were and gave me an opportunity to redress them. So just to use the online example, which was what you were using, I was definitely much more like what you were describing, you know, back, say, 5 years ago, you know, on social media. Yeah. All the things that you just said are exactly the sort of things that I was, you know, reacting to comments, like getting involved in fights, like, you know, just really. And then I was not enjoying that. That was not a good experience for me. As everyone who works with me at Gruen knows, though, I'm not one of those people who quits these things. I hate the performative quitting of a social media. I said, you can always just step back for a minute. Nobody needs to know that you've left the party, right? You can just ghost out of there. And so I ghosted it out for a little while and I experimented with not reading comments. I don't read comments now. I don't read any of the responses or replies. And I don't really tweet a lot anymore, but I share a heap. I basically have a entire feed that is, if something is going on in America, as I want to read about, you know, the various opinions on looting and the dynamics of looting and social justice, if I find stuff along the way that has been helpful to me, that tends to be what my feed is. So by the end of it, you get a pretty good idea about, you know, where I'm falling on these issues and what my thoughts are, but a lot of it is really through sharing and elevating of others. And I don't say that to pat myself on the back, like, look at me creating a voice for these people. It's more because that's been how I can best engage with it in a way that I go, this is a really positive experience. But the minute that I start to go on and compose my own tweet about this, that's when I get back into, oh, hang on, no, now I feel like I'm going to have to check what people have said and my shoulders get tight. And so it's taught me by being what I didn't like, it's taught me a lot about how I could find what it was that I did like.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes like the most important thing that you can say is nothing. You know, sometimes it you actually do need to provide a space for
Will my opinion on this help? Voices. Is anyone sitting around going, what does Ando think? They don't need everybody else. People have got a voice.
Well, you know, I think they probably are, to be honest. But I think when they kind of to look you up, then they see a whole bunch of stuff that you've shared and a whole bunch of people that you've retweeted. And they kind of, as you said, get your position without actually needing to have you tweet about it. But this became so stark to me during this pandemic of like, especially in the early sort of weeks when we weren't really sure what was going to happen and Scott Morrison was still going to the football when things were kicking off in Italy and you know, shit looked like it could potentially be a lot worse than what it's ended up being. I just sort of thought to myself, I need to just shut the fuck up. And like, no one needs to hear my opinion in this moment, even though, to be fair, I did make two videos. But both of those videos had the same message, which was, please just listen to the experts. Listen to only two people. One, the experts, and two, me telling you to listen to the experts. And that's it.
You are an expert in that. That is it. That is your area of expertise, making videos that tell people what to do. So technically, well, still listening to an expert.
No, but I'm definitely not an expert on the pandemic. And I was getting so genuinely concerned about just all of these different voices that were, you know, speaking about it and having an opinion about it and, you know, people sharing certain posts that weren't sort of, you know, scientifically valid or detailed. And I just thought, this is a moment where journos, commentators, media personnel, as much as possible, just need to either shut the fuck up, step aside, or use their platform to point to the direction of the experts, the immunologists, the scientists, the public health experts. This is the moment where they need the space to say what they need to say. So sometimes it's so much more valuable actually to say nothing, you know? And COVID was sort of felt like one of those times.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you've got to, it's a hard one, isn't it? Like, you don't want to say nothing can be a whole bunch of different things. You know, say nothing can be someone not wanting to get involved in a fight, and sometimes people need your help, you know, in the fight. But also, yes, absolutely. I think there are many times where I'm just like, well, that's not helping. That's just not helping. That didn't make anything better.
Yeah.
What was the purpose of that?
I sort of also thought to myself, like, okay, how can I use this? How can I best use this medium that I have in this moment? Like, what is the best use of my time and space right now? You know? And I felt that it was really just pointing in the direction of people who knew about pandemics and who knew about public health and who knew about all of that. So I wasn't entirely useless. I was, you know, I'd like to think still quite useful without necessarily having to, you know, inject thoughts and opinions.
It probably feels like it was a million years ago now, because the nature of time itself, you know, has been warped during what's been going on. But can you run me through your pandemic journey? I would like to know, you know, when did you start to think it was real? This is one that's interesting to me, because I am going to pay for this for the rest of my life, because I was in Adelaide at the Adelaide Fringe, and I was, you know, the whole time my partner, she was quite worried about what was going on and how bad it was going to be. And I was just going on the fact that, you know, I mean, of course, you know, SARS and all these things were terrible, but we live in a very lucky country with the kind of universal healthcare, you know, at least compared to a lot of other places, and we're in Ireland and these things don't normally affect us as much. And I was just going through all those same rationalizations of, this won't be what it has obviously become. So I'm never going to be able to actually offer anything as fact for the rest of my life, because I've already known, like, the pandemic isn't even over. And but you said the pandemic wasn't going to happen. Arguments come up a fair bit already. So it wasn't until they cancelled the NBA in America. When they cancelled the NBA in America, yeah. That was the first night where I was like, there's no way they're going to let us do the comedy festival if they're not letting the NBA go ahead in America.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny that you say that, because I feel like I'm you in my relationship. I am the Will Anderson of my own relationship, because my partner, who I can absolutely denigrate now on this podcast because he was 100% correct and has been vindicated, let me just say, but he cottoned onto this in February, like in mid-February. He was saying, I don't think we should go outside. I think we should stay inside. I don't think we should go... You know when he cottoned onto it? Mardi Gras. That was for me, that was the first sort of big moment where he's like, I don't think we should go to the Mardi Gras. And at this point, nobody was saying anything about not gathering in crowds or, you know, not celebrating or not doing anything like that. And so we didn't go to the Mardi Gras. And he sort of flew into prep mode. Like, when I say prep mode, Will, I am sitting in my office right now at home and there is a freezer next to me. Okay. He went and bought a freezer, and he went and bought a vacuum seal machine, and he vacuum sealed a number of fruits and vegetables and cooked meals and garlic and ginger. And I've got limes, Will. I've got vacuum sealed limes in my freezer, sir. I ask you, you know, and he was doing this before anything kicked off. So I, of course, I'm thinking I've married an insane man, and now I'm going to have to get divorced. Like, this is the only way, you know? And, you know,
you're still going to get half of those vacuum sealed limes though. So that's fine, you know?
Oh, of course. No, that's legally very sound. Yeah. Half of his stuff is mine. Yeah. Including the ragu that we've got vacuum sealed in our freezer as well. Yeah, I'm not joking. mate, you think I'm not joking? Well, while you losers are eating spam out of a bag in a car park, I'm going to be eating ragu. That's right, because it's frozen in a vacuum sealed bag in my second freezer. So he was sort of doing this before any of it kicked off, and he was like, He was the king of the text. He was texting everyone. Hey, I think you should read this. I think you should know about this. I don't think you should go to Japan. I think you should, you know, to the point where some people were texting me going, what's going on with Al?
Right. Because that feels like, you know, it feels like one of those people who's discovered memes on Facebook. You know, it feels a little like he's going down a conspiracy theory hole and everyone's like, is he okay? And except he was right.
Except he was right. That's the thing. He was totally right. And what he was saying in mid-February, basically the government was started saying in mid-March. So he was just 1 month ahead of the curve. And, you know, I've had to acknowledge that and I have to say you were right. Thank you for the ragu. So we sort of cottoned onto it quite early on. And you know, we were very good. Like we didn't really leave the house that much. There was a period where, I mean, we bought a treadmill, so we weren't exercising outdoors. We had our groceries delivered. Normally we just like pop down to the shops, but we started getting groceries delivered. So we were sort of doing everything that we could do to just, you know, minimize contact, stay home.
Was your work impacted? Were you suddenly someone who was without any work, or was he without any work because of when COVID arrived?
Yeah. So he lost basically his work kind of ground to a halt. So he's a director. Nobody was shooting, you know, nobody's making any kind of TV or any kind of commercials at this time. And a lot of my work, I did lose a fair bit of work just with, you know, events and, you know, scheduled to do something at the Comedy Fest as well, and just conferences, book launches, all of the sort of stuff that I had planned, a lot of the travel that I had planned to do as well came to an end. But I've been very fortunate in that I've been able to kind of do some of the podcasts that I do from home. So some of the work translated to being able to be done from home, but a bunch of others didn't.
So how did you deal with that just in a personal sense? Now, with the proviso, because I feel like it probably does need to be acknowledged, which is that, you know, people's experiences of the pandemic can be very extreme. There are some people who are already the most vulnerable in our society who are, you know, increasingly impacted by the effects of something like this and happens than other people. But if you've lost anything, anyone has to deal with that. Were you contextualizing it in a world sense? Were you feeling personal loss or personal hurt from opportunities that were taken away from you? What was your just personal dealing with, you know, the idea that you were going to be doing some things and then suddenly you weren't doing those things?
Yeah. Look, I felt bummed. I think bummed is probably the best way to describe it. It was a real bummer because I was looking forward to doing, you know, the sort of events that I'd had scheduled. I had always just sort of kept in the back of my mind that as shit as this is and as frustrating as it is, I'm going to be okay. You know, I'm in a relationship. I don't have any children, so I'm not now thinking about homeschooling children while also working at the same time. You know, no one's sick in my house, so we're not vulnerable. We're not immunocompromised. So already we were sort of starting from a baseline of, yes, this is shit, but I think in the end we're going to be okay. And that had sort of, that perspective had always sort of kept me feeling kind of okay about everything. It did start to get a bit claustrophobic after a while. I'm very glad that the restrictions in New South Wales eased when they did, because I was sort of on that cusp of like, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to do something dumb. And then they announced that restrictions were easing and I thought, oh, okay. I feel good that I can at least sort of, you know, go outside and meet with however many people, 5 people in a room or whatever.
When a government eases restrictions, they go back to 5 people. A lot of people just thought that meant it was over and you could do whatever you want. You don't need to social distance. From my experience of just looking around, there are a lot of people who have decided if we can go back to 5 people, that's really the government saying we can do whatever we want. Obviously, we can't go to, you know, watch the footy or whatever, but when we're down the park, there can be 10 of us and we can kick a footy around and we can all, you know, drink from the same drink bottle or whatever. So do you think a government, when they're planning easing of restrictions, expect us all to follow them? Or do you think that they put that in their, you know, planning that if we say this, we expect... Does that make sense? Is that a question that makes sense?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think so. I think there's kind of got to be like one psychologist in the, you know, the round table meetings that goes, now look, if you say that only five people are allowed in the room, people are going to have 50. So you need to be aware, you know. So I think to some extent there probably was a bit of anticipation that and people had been cooped up for a while, right? You know, so there probably was some anticipation that, hey, there might end up being a little bit more than five people, or not everyone's going to be sitting 1.5 meters apart. Because to be honest, I think that's a bit unrealistic. You know, if you're going to a dinner party, I don't know who has a table big enough to seat six people 1.5 meters apart on a dinner table. You know, so I think that there was probably some level of like cognizance that people would kind of push the boundaries a little bit further than what was sort of stipulated. It's just, it's almost weirder to say you can have 10 people, but you have to abide by a one person every four square meter footage. Like that's just, that almost seems weirder and harder to abide by than just saying you can't have anyone. You know what I mean? Like, what's everyone going to be out there with the tape measure going, okay, hang on a second, is that 1.5 meters? Is this one person per four square meters? Yeah, and I was speaking to my local barista the other day who was saying it's almost like not worth doing to have those rules. Like it would almost just be easier to just like not open up until you can open up properly. But I understand the need to want to get like the economy up and running as well. You know what I found the hardest is like seeing mates who I haven't seen in ages and then not hugging them. Like you just have to do this like weird distant like bow. It's just because we don't have any other acknowledgement of hello, right? Like it's either like a handshake, a hug, a kiss. How else do you acknowledge that, yes, I have missed you? You know, I found myself like curtsying or just being like waving from a distance. Like, I really like you. I want to hug you. But it's illegal, you know?
Okay, so I'm not really interested in your opinion on this, but what does Elle think about the idea of a second wave?
You know, he's a lot more, he has much more restraint on this than I do. The other day, so how's this for a modern day conundrum? Listeners, I wanted to go to a dinner party and he did not want to go to the dinner party because, you know, he wasn't sure who was going to be at the dinner party. He didn't know, you know, are we going to be eating from the same plate at the dinner party or like the same whatever salad from the same bowl? Had they washed their vegetables properly at this dinner party? There was a lot of unknowns. And so he didn't want to go to the dinner party, but I did want to go to the dinner party. Yeah. And so, but if I went to the dinner party, then it means that he's just one person away from all of the people at the dinner party. So should I go to the dinner party? Like, it's such a weird space to be in when you're in a relationship and you both live in the one apartment and one of you wants to do this other thing and the other one doesn't. It's almost like you both have to agree to either do it or not do it.
Well, that's right. So what can you tell me what the resolution of that was? Did you go to the dinner party?
Yeah, fuck him. I went to the dinner party. I was like, I'm done. I'm done, bro. I'm going to the dinner party. Good luck. You know, I mean, I was good. I was cautious. I wasn't like, you know, hugging people or kissing people or whatever it was. But yeah, I'm like, I'm going to the dinner party. I said to him, because we, like, he's the best. Let me just preface. He's the absolute best. We have great kind of comms. But I sort of said, I was like, I know that this marriage contract that we've entered into sort of means that my decisions have consequences for you. And I'm like, can we suspend that? Can we suspend the marriage contract for a period of weeks where I cannot be held responsible for my decisions affecting you? Like, is there any way we can do that, you know? And no is the short answer to that question. You can't. So I think we're just sort of playing scenarios by ear now as they arise.
It is an interesting thing that you mentioned, though, which is that idea of, do you think, just as a hypothetical situation, do you think if this disease could have only affected you? So if you went to that dinner party and the only risk is to your health rather than to also risking his health, Does that make sense as a scenario so far?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you be more or less or the same cautious as you were at that dinner party? Did you take extra precautions because, you know, you were worried about him than you would have taken for your own safety if it was only you were worried about?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know what that says about me, but yeah, I probably would be a little bit more cavalier. Not too cray, but I probably wouldn't think about my actions as deliberately as what I have been. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, like I go in and record a podcast Thursday and Friday mornings, and, you know, I'm and he's like, now make sure you wipe down the desk and make sure you wipe down the popper on the mic. And, you know, so I'm like, all right, I'm going to do that. I'm doing it. But I think if, you know, I wasn't in a relationship or it didn't have any kind of consequences for him, I probably would get a bit lax in doing that.
What's your general regard for your own welfare? Like historically, like, are you a risk taker? Are you a person who, you know, enjoys the idea of putting yourself in, you know, a dangerous situation? Or are you a person who, you know, is pretty, you know, cognizant and respectful of your health? Where would you put yourself on a sliding scale?
I'd probably put myself, I'm one of those people that's like, if I have to do 10,000 small things that annoy me to avoid one big risk that's unlikely to happen, I would rather just take the risk that it won't happen and not do the 10,000 small things.
Right.
So that's me. Yeah. So it's like, whereas he's like, but all it is just a small thing that you have to do to mitigate that big risk. Yeah. And I'm like, but I don't want to do that small thing. I just want to take the risk that that big thing doesn't happen.
And he just, yeah. He's in the court of vac sealing a ragu. Just going.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I think I'm sort of measured in that regard, but I hate doing like a bunch of small annoying things to avoid a big risk that is looking unlikely to happen anyway. I'd just rather take that risk.
I can't remember if I asked you this last time. A person who was better at their job than me would have gone back and listened. But while I'm sure I would have enjoyed your part of the podcast, I would have hated the bits I was in. So I
think we talked for 2.5 hours as well. So I don't blame you for not going back and listening to 2.5 hours, even though it was very interesting.
It's very good. And if this is the first one you're listening to, please go back and listen to that one. But what I was going to say was, I don't know if I asked you what you're most afraid of. If I did ask you, or do you know what it is that you're most afraid of, and has that changed at all, you know, with the current state of the world?
What am I most afraid of? I'll tell you something that sits in the back of my mind a lot more than what you would think it sits in the back of my mind, which is shaming my parents.
Oh, doesn't surprise me at all. I've seen your work.
Yeah, okay.
Oh,
what's up?
No, the reason it doesn't surprise me at all is I think that is my genuine greatest fear, without a doubt, is shaming my parents. And I feel like there are certain things that I have not said that, or I've left unsaid over my life, because the only thing that's holding me back is not that they would lead to some sort of, that personally they would reflect badly on me, but that if they reflected badly on me, they would also reflect badly on my parents. And that's an overwhelming thing to me, is to, I know that a lot of what I do, like, you know, they get flack for. I stopped doing shows in my hometown because people, if they didn't like something, wouldn't complain to me. They complained to my parents, and I'm fine. People can complain to me, and I can deal with that however I want to deal with it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to, you know, feel like I'm causing problems for my mum and dad going about their daily business in the tiny little community that they live in, just because I've been off, you know, talking about drugs with Judith Lucy on my podcast or something.
Yeah.
So, no, okay. I think about that a lot. So when you said that I really absolutely related to that.
Oh, I'm so glad you did, because, yeah, I guess I'm not really surprised to hear that coming from you as well, especially given that your parents live in a sort of small, close-knit town. It's sort of similar for me as well. I mean, my background's Lebanese, and, you know, the Lebanese community in Sydney is very sort of tight. and can be very conservative a lot of the times. And so when you're kind of publicly out there talking about certain things and, you know, alluding to certain things and being really open about whatever your life and your ideas and politics and religion and all of this kind of stuff that normally, you know, shouldn't be talked about in polite company or whatever it is, I think sometimes that does tend, I worry that it, that my parents have to deal with it. Because I'm okay with people, you know, complaining to me, as you said, but I just, I would hate to think that my parents would be bearing the brunt of the work that I do. And look, so far, so good. You know, no one's hugely said anything to me, but that does sit in the back of my mind daily.
Yeah, it's because I'm further processed through the journey also. You know, I've got to the point where if somebody says something cruel about something that I have done or misrepresents, you know, who I am or what it is that I've said in some sort of context for their own purposes, I've got to the point where I'm like, okay, well, this is just part of the game in which I'm involved. I don't like this part of it, but it is part of it, and I'm grown up enough to realize that it's part of it, and I'm also grown up to realize that the only thing that I can possibly do about it is ignore it and move on and just keeping doing what I want to do. I'm there, but it's taken me 25 years to get there, and there's been a lot of times where I was not there, and there may be times again in the future where I am not there again because it can be very circumstance, you know, related, you know, depending on what the fucking thing is. But I know my parents take all that stuff much more personally. You know, if somebody, you know, says something about you or misrepresents you, my parents feel that in a way that I don't feel that. So, yeah, that's a very good answer. We're running out of time because we can't do 2.5 hours today. So we're running out of time.
Oh, boo!
I mean, to be honest, you know, I probably could. I'm at home. You know, really all I'm going to do after this is go upstairs and maybe make some banana bread. But obviously, we finish, you know, every episode by giving our guests an opportunity to pay tribute to Alan Jones, the greatest broadcaster in the history of Australian broadcasting. And obviously, you know, I know that you personally were a massive fan of Alan, so you would have been devastated to see him no longer on the national airwaves.
Yeah, I did. I cried myself to sleep for the last few weeks, Will. It's really, it's been painful for me. Mm-hmm.
Big loss for your community, I imagine. They would have been really...
Do you want to know something funny? I think a lot of Lebs really like Alan.
Is that right? Why?
Well,
I mean, because of course any group is not fucking like that.
Yeah.
No, any group doesn't think the same thing. So of course that said, obviously. But secondly, what is it specifically about when you say a lot of, what is it that you think they like about Alan?
I mean, I think a lot of, you know, this is obviously we're sort of speaking in generalizations here, but generally the community is quite conservative. It's quite a religious community. And it doesn't really matter whether you're a Muslim or Christian. Religion is very prevalent either way. And so I think Alan Jones speaks to that a lot, you know. And you have members of the community who, you know, they're small business owners. They're folks that live out in, you know, Western Sydney. There's a very big kind of Lebanese population there in Western Sydney. So it's, you know, the audience I think that Alan Jones speaks to and perhaps speaks for. And obviously groups, like any group in society, is not a homogenous entity, right? So, the you know, we can't sit there and assume that they all either like him or they all don't like him. But, you know, the man was found to have incited violence in the lead up to the Cronulla riots. Like, I didn't make that up. I heard what he said. And I think in large part what happened in Cronulla in 2005 was really exacerbated and encouraged verbatim by Alan Jones. And let me tell you, like I said to you last time we had this chat, you know, if you've ever had to watch on television someone hold up a sign that says fuck off Lebs, you're not really going to have too much respect for anybody that's either incited or encouraged that and particularly spruiked it from a very powerful media platform.
What do you think the appeal of Alan Jones was? Did you ever listen to much of the show? Like, were you a person who dipped into it to have... I had tried in the period of time where I was very much of the idea that I should be listening to, you know, a wide variety of voices and ideas. And perhaps even there was some validity to that back when those extreme ideas weren't so extreme. It just got to the point where I was like, well, this isn't relevant to me at all because this is just ridiculous to me. What was his appeal, do you think? Did you listen to some of it?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to some of his radio shows. And again, it was sort of just trying to understand that very question of, okay, well, obviously there are people who listen to Alan Jones and, sort of trying to understand what is the appeal in Alan Jones for them. And I think he speaks to a certain, section of the population that I guess would feel not really represented as well in other sections of the media, perhaps. I think he cuts through a lot of the bullshit. He does. And it depends on what you see as being bullshit, really. That will then depend on what you see as him cutting through. But he does have quite a lot of cut through. And, you know, he speaks very plainly and very simply, and he's very passionate when he speaks. He's very knowledgeable when he speaks. And he does, you do get a sense that he is advocating for someone. He's advocating for something. And that can be very powerful for listeners. I think that he has, you know, frayed the moral and social fabric of this country. And I didn't get too much pleasure from listening to his radio show, but I can see why people would have.
I spoke to Alex Dyson, formerly of the Triple J Breakfast Show, and he ran for Parliament, and I was speaking to him about the fact that he was there handing out how to vote cards with a guy from Pauline Hanson's One Nation, but that he had got on very well with this guy, and in a lot of ways they had a lot in common. And, you know, we were speaking about the idea that everyone believes that everything's, it's what you said, that one person's bullshit is not another person's bullshit, and one person's common sense is not another person's common sense. Everyone believes they're speaking common sense. It's just that they're speaking about a completely different thing, a bunch of things they think is common sense. How do we reach across the aisle? It's a hard question when everything is so fractured now, when everything is at such extremes. Firstly, yeah. Is there value in reaching across to your enemy? Is that a waste of time? Is there value in you consuming, you know, what the opposite of what you think is saying? Or is that a waste of your time where you should be doing more positive things? Is it worth engaging with them, or is it not worth engaging with them?
I mean, there's a long answer to that question. The short answer is yes. Of course, it's worth understanding what people that you don't agree with think. And at times that helps you either change your opinion or that helps you sharpen your opinion. And if you're not engaging with the work of people who disagree with you and who come from a fundamentally different perspective, you're not going to have a sharp perspective yourself. That's point number one. Is it a waste of time trying to change people's minds? I mean, that's what, you know, anyone who's ever written anything, said anything, spoken anything, that's all they're trying to do is to put something out there and to, you know, hopefully give people a new way of understanding. So I'd like to think that no, it's not a waste of time. Whether it works is another question, and whether it works efficiently and quickly is another question. But on the point of how do we do that, it really just comes down to one word, and that word is read. You have to read. You have to read books. You have to read what people have written, and you have to understand that what happens today has probably happened before and comes in context. And the more knowledge that you have about something, the more you are able to speak about it with a certain degree of nuance, and the more you are able to understand your position on it and also opposing positions on it. And I get that reading is... and this is something that I think about so much because I feel like being on social media has really impeded my ability to read. It has, you know, messed with my, it's messed with my attention span. It's messed with my ability to concentrate. It's messed with my ability to sort of just sit there and be present in a moment without needing to check what's going on online. And I've tried to reclaim reading in light of that, you know, and I've tried, and, you know, I'm not getting on a high horse about reading books, by the way. Like, I find it quite difficult, you know. I can't read without having post-it notes and actually writing things down because nothing sticks in my mind. And sometimes it takes me a while to read a single book, and that's fine. I'm okay with that. Like, I'm not out here trying to compete with anyone for reading points. But if you really want to understand why you believe what you believe and why other people believe what they believe and why it is that we are here today and how we've gotten to this point and how we can move forward, you need to read, and you need to have a deeper breadth of understanding that doesn't come from social media, I think.
There is a rush right now, at least amongst certain parts of, the society, for everything to get back to normal. And, one of those new bits of language that we have now is this idea of the new normal. What do you hope the new normal might have that the old normal didn't have? Or are you not hopeful that that we will take any of what we've learned from this experience into, when we get back to normal?
I hope that the new normal will have an appreciation of the people that have kept this society going. And that has been doctors and nurses, that has been teachers, that has been supermarket staff, that has been drivers, that has been cleaners. They are our most valuable people, and I think that this pandemic has shown that. They were the ones on the front lines. They were the ones that kept the communities and the societies and essentially this country going when we were uncertain of what would happen. And I hope that they are appreciated more, and I hope that they are paid more. I hope that that's something that we take away in the new normal. And I think that, I think that there are lessons that we have learned, and there are lessons that I am optimistic that we will not just take from this time, but sort of implement and run with. That's one of them. And just the idea of let go of FOMO. Let it go. You don't need to be there. You don't need to do that thing. You don't need to, get this thing done as fast as possible. It's okay. There's having a little bit more time and space can be a good thing.
Says the woman who went to the germ-infested dinner party orgy. So
yes, I did. Because of FOMO, of course.
What of this will you take out of it? Is there something that has changed in the way you've thought or the way that you lived your life through this that you will take back into the new normal?
I've realized how much I really like my husband, that we've had to spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week together for almost 3 months. You really start to have a profound appreciation of that person. So I've sort of taken that away. I really like the indoors, Will. That's something that I kind of knew about myself, but that has just been really cemented by this need, the legal requirement, rather, to stay indoors. I like being inside more than what I thought I did. So sometimes the idea of nature, the idea of being out in big spaces, I don't know if it's just me, but the idea of kind of returning to the world and being out in big spaces, and I'm a little bit apprehensive about it.
All right. We have to finish up. This has been great. Thank you so much for doing it. I really do genuinely appreciate it. Can I ask you, I've been asked, so I've got a Patreon, patreon.com/willosophy. Please sign up, people, because this is now my official job. So I am essentially a podcast busker. So I am asking, if you've enjoyed this, could you please contribute to the Patreon, patreon.com/willosophy. I will say on that, because I think it speaks to what you were speaking to. One of the things I've been doing is, because I said to you, I don't really read replies on social media anymore, but my Patreon page, because there are people here who are supporting me through this time, and I think if they listen to this podcast and they want to support the podcast, it's probably a cool little community. If people message me there, I always respond. And of course, because of the nature of what it is, it's the Patreon page for this style of podcast. What often happens is someone will write you quite a long piece or message about one particular guest or something that someone said or somehow how it was important to them and related to their life. So it's been really lovely, particularly during a time where I haven't been working. I haven't been doing the thing that normally sort of gives me that external validation. To read these messages from people and how heartfelt they are has been, absolutely fantastic. And I will take back, I hope, I've always had an appreciation for the people who support what it is that I do so that I can keep doing it. But in this time when their support is literally the support that gets me through the day so that I can buy food and, you know, get on with my life at the moment in a just a very literal sense. But then that extra step of them sharing a story or an idea or a bit of feedback or whatever with me has made me really appreciate just going, oh, look at these people. Look at these amazing people who've been here for me when I needed them. And I hope that I take that back into when things get back to normal, really thinking about the people who support me doing what I do as, you know, as important as, of course, they have always been. But it's been a very nice thing is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there is something that, you know, the internet is never entirely good and never entirely bad. And I think the communities that you form in some of these spaces are really valuable, like in your real life. And like that, the point that you made really speaks to that.
You have podcasts and things that we can plug. So let's plug some things.
Yes. Listen to The Briefing every morning from 6 a.m. with me, Jan Fran, co-host Tom Tilley, Annika Smethurst and Jamila Rizvi. It is all you need to know to get your morning started. Headlines, and then we delve deep into a briefing topic.
And this will be a briefing week because Jamila's episode is going to go up this week as well. So you'll be able to listen to her on the podcast as well this week for anybody's interested. But yeah, it's a great podcast. And if you want to know, I mean, it's great in that way of going, if you want to wake up and hear some, you know, smart people give you a sense of, you know, what people are going to be talking about, it's the perfect thing to listen to.
Yep. But I think you spruced it better than I did. No. Good on you. Like, all right, mate, yep, you've got it. I don't need to be here. Cheers.
I was asked on Patreon the reason that I brought it up by one of the people, because you can give me some feedback there, and this one was absolutely brilliant. I'm going to try to chase down the name of the person who actually asked the question so that I can give them full credit for it. But they said, could you please ask people the time travel question again? So at the end of the podcast, I ask, I have a time machine. You can go to anywhere on a round trip on a time machine. I would have asked you this last time. I can't remember what you said, but you have a second shot anyway. This is a second trip, so you can go anywhere. Time machine, your own life, or throughout history.
I mean, I probably would go to, you know, 2,000 years ago Bethlehem and just work out what the fuck went on there. You know what I mean? Just get a definitive answer to that question once and for all, I think. I would see that more as a civic duty rather than like the trip of a lifetime that I would want to take. But I think someone's got to ascertain whether Jesus was a thing and in fact the Son of God.
Okay.
And if I could just get to him 2,000 years ago and just say, hey, mate, just some quick questions for you, I think I'd do that.
Okay, so let's just follow this just a tiny little bit more if you have a couple more minutes. So, okay,
yeah.
You've gone back in time to talk to Jesus Christ to work out if he's the Son of God or not. What are you asking him to ascertain that?
Oh, well, see, I'd need to take some things with me, wouldn't I? I'd need to take some tests and maybe a scientist who can administer those tests. You know, it's just a simple DNA, a simple swab of the mouth there, Jesus. Won't be too long. We'll figure out what's going on momentarily. Because I just think the last 2,000 years, a lot of people have said a lot of shit. And look, there's no real way of knowing, is there? So if there was any real way of knowing, that it'd be
great. Don't you fear, though, that if people knew definitively one way or the other, that would just be the end of the planet? Like, there would be so many people having existential, you know, kind of, you know, breakdowns one way or the other, that the whole place would burn down.
I mean, have you taken a look at what's going on with the planet of late? Yeah, it's not doing too good, is it?
I mean, it's not going great, sure, but like I'm just saying.
It's not going great.
I'm just saying, look, it possibly could be even worse.
Yeah, look, I think if we're going to have an existential crisis, let's have one based on as much facts and truth as possible.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
All right, and how would you feel about the fact that if the fact was that he was indeed the Son of God, would that be confronting?
Oh, fuck yeah. I'm converting in a sec. Well, I mean, I'm baptized, so I've got access to the pearly gates, mate. No worries. But yeah, oh, for sure. If he's the Son of God, you kidding me?
See? That's all it takes. That's all it takes for you, being able to travel back in time 2,000 years to administer a DNA test. And if I can do that, I'll believe.
I'll agnostic. Believe. Exactly.
That's what I am.
I'm the Thomas who still hasn't converted yet. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dan Fran. I really appreciate you doing this today. And thank you.
Yeah, pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me again.